It remains an unfortunate fact of life that money can't buy happiness. It can, however, buy you a new shirt, magnet, sticker, mug, or journal featuring exclusive designs related to this podcast. By visiting ahistoryofjapan.threadless.com and buying some of the items featured there, you get yourself something beautiful and help support this podcast at the same time. Again, that's ahistoryofjapan.threadless.com. Visit the store today. Hello, and welcome to A History of Japan. Season 3, Episode 5, Who Ruled in Kofun, Japan? By the end of the Yayoi period, there are many indications that an effort toward unification was beginning to bear fruit. The records of Wei and other accounts from the 200 CE tell us not only of specific monarchs like Queen Himiko, but also of diplomatic envoys to and from mainland China. While there is still considerable controversy regarding where exactly Queen Himiko's legendary nation of Yamatai was located, what is generally agreed is that by the late 200s, there was a growing power in Kansai, which was successfully keeping the allegiance of regional powers, likely through some authority over the seasonal religious rituals which the average person in those years believed were necessary to ensure bountiful harvests and general prosperity. Kansai, however, is a big place, so we should start by narrowing our field. The area where this powerful polity emerged is known as the Nara Basin in the south-central of Kansai. In ancient times, its name was Yamato. The Nara Basin itself is a large stretch of flat land surrounded by heavily forested mountains. The land itself is, to this day, very fertile and flat. In many ways, the entire valley is ideal for growing rice and other crops. The scenic mountains that hem the area became the source of inspiration for many poets and painters. It's easy to see how the regional polity here had some large advantages over their neighbors in nearly every source of political power in Kofun-era Japan. Surplus food production meant both a growing population and the general impression that the rituals performed by the Nara Basin religious authorities were effective. Combined with the market advantage of offering food to nearby polities in exchange for fealty, and you have a potent recipe for power consolidation. Because the Yamato region was governed by several clans who all acted nominally on behalf of a monarchical dynasty, we generally refer to its leadership as the Yamato Court. This term refers to the socio-political organization of these clans, not an actual physical court. The official story told by the Yamato court several hundred years after the Kofun period claims that the royal dynasty was founded in 660 BCE by Emperor Jimmu, who was descended both from the sun goddess Amaterasu, as well as her brother, the storm god Susanoo no Mikoto. Originally from southern Kyushu, Emperor Jimmu set out to conquer the rest of Japan and, after some initial setbacks and lessons learned along the way, established himself in Yamato. Jimmu inherited a Tsurugi sword named Kusanagi, or Grass Cutter, a sacred mirror called Yata no Kagami, and a sacred curved gem called Yasakani no Magatama. These were originally gifts from Amaterasu, who desired that Japan become a civilized state. Today, these items are referred to as the Three Sacred Treasures, or the Imperial Regalia of Japan. They are kept secretly hidden in various shrines and temples around Japan, and only ever seen by the emperor and few select priests in private coronation ceremonies. these items would become must-haves for later kingmakers and power brokers, as it was considered impossible for an emperor to have legitimacy if he did not have access to the three sacred treasures. As I hope you understand by now, the official story does not reflect true history. There is a temptation to dispose of these stories as useless, outdated propaganda, but I think that goes too far. Even if something is created as propaganda, it still contains information that we can learn from without accepting said information at face value. Were Romulus and Remus really raised by wolves? Did Romulus really murder his brother for mocking the foundations of Rome's walls? These stories are obviously mythological in nature, but it is still important to know those stories if you hope to understand the attitudes and worldviews of the people who believed they were true. We still have to live with a certain amount of mystery, unfortunately, and in some places, I will have to be vague because ultimately there are pieces of this puzzle which remain stuffed under the couch cushions of history. Thanks to reconstruction and archaeology, we can discover the truths behind the chronicler's tales. We now understand that hunting and gathering Jomon people lived on Japan first, and that the Yayoi brought rice cultivation when they gradually emigrated to Japan, most likely from the Korean Peninsula. So where did the Yamato dynasty come from? Historians generally agree that the earliest emperor to whom they can accurately assign dates is Emperor Kinmei, who ruled from 539 to 571. This does not mean that every emperor alleged to have come before him is absolutely mythical, only that the dates are, shall we say, squishy. We have some certainty about Kinmei Tenno's forebears, insofar as we are relatively certain of their existence, but their birth year, the years of their reigns, and even the events of their lives remain somewhat elusive. Thus, you can imagine how difficult it is to trace the dynasty's origins. They may have descended from Yayoi polities, maybe even from Queen Himiko herself. But a new theory has emerged that may be gaining traction among academic historians. This theory is that Kansai experienced a Korean invasion sometime in the late 200s or 300 CE, and that the Yamato and other peninsular clans, possibly from Baekje originally, established themselves in Kansai and quickly came to dominate the rest of the nation through brute force, adoption of local customs, and strategic diplomacy. It is true that the Kofun period is littered with evidence of significant Korean immigration. Many coastal towns sprang up throughout northern Kansai in this period, and archaeological excavations of those areas have uncovered peninsular-style pottery, implements, and, most importantly, horses. The Kofun period is when we finally see horses in Japan, brought over by Korean migrants for work and travel. Horses also carry an obvious military application and conferred significant advantages to soldiers in battle. And then there's the Haniwa. Yes, it's time to return to the Haniwa statues I mentioned in the previous episode, which are clearly wearing trousers under iron skirts. Proponents of the Korean invasion theory claim that it is difficult to explain trousers on soldiers without horses for said soldiers to ride. Combine this with the close relationship which Japan enjoyed with Baekje, according to the Samguk Sami, Baekje frequently sent its crown princes to Wa as wards in exchange for Japanese military assistance, as well as the fact that many of the powerful clans of the Yamato period claimed peninsular ancestry, and there is certainly a case to be made. However, wearing pants in warfare has many applications besides ease of horse riding. Charging the enemy on foot in a long skirt is a good way to fall on your face. Pants may have been the result of cultural exchange with the peninsula, and been adopted initially as a kind of fad. While many of the powerful Kofun and later Asuka clans claim peninsular origins, this can be explained by simple migration. Regarding the close relationship with Baekje, that unfortunate kingdom suffered an extended decline and grew more and more desperate as its foes grew more able and more powerful. Their willingness to give hostages for military alliance might speak more to that desperation than any blood relation with the Yamato court. I am certainly willing to entertain the idea that this supposed invasion may have occurred. The records from the 300s are just sparse enough to allow the possibility. At the moment, however, the whole thing sounds too much like a just-so story to me. A group from Baekje conquered Kansai, and that's why so many clans come from Korea, and that's why the Yamato had such friendly relations with Baekje, and that's why the soldiers wore trousers. Generally, such theories, whether of a historical or scientific nature, are trying to answer too many questions at once, and thus they fall apart the moment someone finds another answer for just one of the questions at hand. My personal opinion on the matter lies somewhere in the middle. I think the Yamato court functioned largely as a religious power through the latter portions of the Yayoi period, and that they continued to function from that basis in the early Kofun period. The distribution of Dotaku bells and the later keyhole tombs certainly seemed to radiate from the Nara Basin where they were headquartered. There is evidence of Korean immigration, but it is difficult to measure the scale. The rapid adoption of horse-mounted warfare suggests that it was significant. I think, and again, I cannot stress enough that this represents only my own opinion on the matter, that the Korean migrants during the early Kofun period adopted a role as the enforcers of the Yamato court and of other petty regional warlords as well. If there were an actual conquest, I believe we would see more evidence than simply a faster-than-normal adoption of a few foreign practices. However, if the migrants came to Japan in hopes of a better life, it seems reasonable that they might offer military service to the most powerful entity they could find, especially those who came early enough to see that their new neighbors did not use horses in battle. A critical thing to keep in mind about the Yamato dynasty is that its power lay in its performance of semi-annual rituals, which were practiced on behalf of the people. I'm going to read a few quotes from George Sansom now, with the cautionary statement that while his books on Japanese history were written in 1958 and therefore do contain some outdated scholarship, they are nevertheless full of clever and cogent observations of the nature of political power in Japan and how that power changed over time. Quote, "The ancient Japanese word, usually translated as government, is matsuri goto, which means literally the business of worship or ceremonial observances." End quote. His description of the monarch's relationship to the people is likewise, in my opinion, quite astute. Quote, "European kings might call themselves sovereign by the grace of God, but the emperors of Japan described themselves as manifest gods, ruling the kingdom upon earth." End quote. He likewise observes that the Nihon Shoki and the Kojiki do not make any kind of argument that the emperor descends from divine heritage and is thus himself an actual living god, but instead begin from the assumption that its readers in the 700s already believed this. It may come as some surprise that during the Kofun period there existed, for a time, a rival kingdom in Japan. It probably won't be a surprise to learn that this kingdom was headquartered in, you guessed it, Chugoku. Just as the western region of Honshu clung to contrary religious rituals both in Yayoi and Kofun, so it seems that the areas south of the Izumo Shrine, there arose the kingdom of Kibi. According to the Nihon Shoki, Prince Kibitsuhiko no Mikoto led many military expeditions to Chugoku to convince its people to submit to Yamato sovereignty. The Kibi promoted different styles of art and religious ritual than the Yamato, and thus have unfortunately landed in the middle of outlandish fringe history theories about their ethnic origins. Suffice to say, I believe the Kingdom of Kibi was composed primarily of Japanese residents, probably with some immigrants from the Korean Peninsula. We do know for certain that the Kingdom of Kibi existed. It was independent of Yamato sovereignty until it was either conquered or finally submitted, at least nominally, to the emperor, likely sometime in the 400s. The statues they produced are interesting because their style is indeed different than most of the rest of the nation. I will post pictures of the Kibi statues on this podcast's website, ahistoryofjapan.com, so that you can see them for yourself, because they are quite fascinating. According to the Nihon Shoki, in 400, the king of Baekje sent scholars to Japan along with several copies of the Chinese classics. Thus, written language officially came to the islands in the form of Chinese pictograms, which the Japanese refer to as kanji, and Confucian political theory was introduced as well. It would be some time before some of the political principles would be attempted, because the clans which had supported the sovereignty of the Yamato king benefited greatly from their system of patronage, and often exercised broadly expansive power of their own in the king's name. To paraphrase Sansom, the imperial sovereigns reigned, but they did not govern, which in part accounts for the Yamato dynasty's longevity itself. But if the Yamato dynasty did not govern, I can hear you asking, then who did? In a future episode, we'll take a closer look at the various clans that supported the king of Yamato, their functions in the administration, and the structure of the court. Next time, we'll explore the art of the Kofun period and what we can learn about the society that produced it. Until then, you can follow the podcast on Twitter at @ahistoryofjapan, visit the online store ahistoryofjapan.threadless.com, and find us on the web ahistoryofjapan.com.